How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Lance Storm here. It's Figure Four Daily, and it is February 28, 2025, figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. And just now, Lance and I were talking about how old we are. Paisley turns 9 years old today. Happy birthday, Paisley.
Happy birthday, Pais.
And meanwhile, your daughter is like, is she collecting Social Security yet or not quite?
Not quite, but my oldest is 28 and will be 29 by the end of the year.
Oh, my God. How? Mm-hmm. How does this happen? Well, we're going to do a live Q&A today, everybody. And so you can ask Lance or myself any questions you would like. And we are free on YouTube and Twitch. And a little bit later on, I'll tell you how to watch all of the shows. We'll do some plugs here after a while. But first off, let's get right into some of the questions here. All you do, if you're on Twitch, put your question in the chat box. And believe it or not, if you're watching on YouTube, you can also put your question in the chat box there. So let's do it. All right, this person says, Lance, what style of music would you prefer for your entrance music for the podcast? Man, we're off to a rocking start here.
Yeah, well, we were using... Oh, what was the name of the song we had? There was a dude that volunteered his
song.
We
had a good song, but it doesn't work when you're on that channel because your gimmick broke down. So
yes, my tie line died ages ago. And what are we going to do now that Skype's shutting down?
Skype is shutting down?
I saw a post that Skype is going to be no more after May 5th.
Wait, hold on a second.
I saw several posts.
Well, this could also be, you know, you're getting old, Lance. You can get fooled by things. Skype shutting down.
Seemed like a random thing to make up.
God damn, it's true. Microsoft shutting down Skype in May. Microsoft is closing down Skype, the video calling service it bought for $8 billion in 2011, which had helped spark a transformation in how people communicate online. It's going to retire in May, shift some of its services to Microsoft Teams. Well, we were actually using Teams for this show for a long time, and then, I don't know, for whatever reason, I put you back on Skype, but it won't affect this show any, but it still will be on that channel. So, apparently it's true, everybody. Skype is shutting down. Breaking news here on this program.
And I still won't be able to have music?
Well, if we can get your tie line fixed. Have you sent that back to Tony?
I sent it back with Vinny.
Okay.
Like, when Vinny was up here visiting... Christ, when was that? 6 months ago?
A long time ago, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this person here says, Lance, have you ever read the book 1984? What are your thoughts? If so, I'm rereading it now. It's scary how similar it is to our current day.
Yeah, I have not. Although the book I just finished reading, a John Gilstrap novel in his Jonathan Graves series, Zero Sum, I think is the title. It had a lot of similarities with modern day politics, if you will, and it was almost to the point where, and again, I really like the author and I like the series, but it was like reading is a bit of an escape. I don't want it to be this dead on. So, yeah, I've avoided most classic or really famous things, and I kind of try to find other authors and books to read. When I first got my Kindle, since classics were free, I'd read a couple, but I've not read 1984.
Wow. So what is on your reading list of late?
I just finished reading the entire Elvis Cole series, rereading it. I had read it in the past, but he had a new one come out in January, so near the tail end of last year, I decided I would go back and reread the 19 previous books in the series leading to the new one. So the last 20 books I read were all Robert Crace Elvis Cole books. And then I've just got a couple of individual books to catch up on. Haven't started it yet, and I don't even recall the title. But the latest T. Jefferson Parker is on my to open and start reading this weekend list.
All right, looks like YouTube was free, but people weren't able to chat. Now they can. And so I see all of you right now watching. Get your questions in, and whatever you want to ask, Lance or I is fair game. This person says, since WWE is now doing so many PLEs all around the world. Would you have liked doing that as a wrestler? How easy is it to adapt to wrestling with very long travel?
Well, I wrestled with very long travel a lot. I flew all the way to Japan for one match and flew home. So I didn't find that an issue, and I certainly would have liked it. I sort of, and it's a regret is far too strong. I found it unfortunate that when I left WWE was just when they started going international more again. Because sort of throughout my career, I thought it would be cool to get to as many countries as possible. So hitting big shows in other countries with WWE would have been great. And again, they started hitting all the European countries and so forth heavy around 2004 and 5, I think, was when they started going again a lot. And I missed out on many of those. So I think I've only actually wrestled in 9, maybe 10 countries. So yeah, hitting big shows around the world would have been great.
Well, we just got a breaking news story here. So tonight on SmackDown, it was supposed to be LA Knight versus Nakamura. And we spent a long time talking about that match on Observer Live today because Nakamura won the title in November and vanished for an entire month and then defended it once. And then, like, this was supposed to be, I believe, his second title defense tonight. And this afternoon, they just announced the match is off. And instead of LA Knight getting the title shot, they are doing a mini tournament to decide who deserves it. Even though LA Knight had already been announced.
Former champion.
Yeah, so something clearly happened. I don't know what it was. Maybe Nakamura isn't ready to go tonight or something like that. Because LA Knight is working the show tonight, so he must be fine. But that's kind of a weird thing.
Good thing that 30-day rule isn't a thing.
Yeah. How about that? And Ricky Saints has officially vacated the Defy title. In case those of you were wondering if he was going to go back as an NXT superstar, the answer is no. I actually asked Matt if I could like put a mask on and play the role of Ricky Starks and drop the title, but apparently I guess they're not going to do that. All right. This person here says, what makes for a great tag team partner?
Well, there's a lot of elements to it, and it can vary. Like, I think William Regal and I were a really good tag team because we were like-minded but very different. Where I was clearly the more athletic guy, but he had, you know, the facial expressions, personality, and an incredible aggressive intensity to him. So there was different aspects of matches that each of us were better suited for. And because we were like-minded, we both realized it and knew it. So if it came time for a faster bump and feed and bigger bumps and more athletic stuff, it's like I'd just be the one to do it. And when there really needed to be a degree of intensity or, again, some of the great facial expressions and personality, he would just do it. And it's like there was no discussion. It's just this is clearly who's better suited for this part of the job. Where Jericho and I think we were a good tag team. We were both green as shit when we were doing it. But we were very similar. But that can work too. And, you know, Justin Credible and I think we're a great team. A, because I trained him, so we were, you know, on the same page mentally. And I think also with Paige and I, because I trained him, he let me be the captain, and we just accepted that. But from a dynamic standpoint in ECW, everyone knows and thinks of, oh, hardcore wrestling with ECW, and PJ's out there in his jean shorts, his t-shirt, and his kendo stick. But there was also the high-end wrestling aspect of ECW that was probably first put on the map with some of the, you know, Malenko-Guerrero matches, where it's like, I was the super athlete, high-end pro wrestler guy in his tights. So we covered both aspects of ECW. So you can have a good tag team, you know, you go to Rockers and stuff like that, where they were very much the same, and then other teams where they complement each other. But I think more than anything, there needs to be that like-mindedness so that you don't have the clash of who's in charge, who's getting highlighted, and the politics aspect of it. So you have to be very like-minded, but I think in a lot of ways also different and diverse.
This person here says, Lance, how was the TNA gig change with the new leadership there, and especially the heavy WWE partnership now?
Well, the heavy partnership hasn't changed my job any, other than there's some new bodies that I get to work with. But it's not like, you know, Sean's coming with them and demanding this until, like, it seems to be a very cooperative relationship where, obviously, you know, if I'm the producer on the Obafemi match, I'm not going to bury the guy because I realize that, you know, WWE wants this guy looking good. So, you know, we're all professionals and working towards the same goal. So I don't think the WWE partnership, I don't think there's any negative to it as far as the working environment goes. And in a lot of ways, like, I find the crowd's so much more into the TNA versus NXT dynamic, because, you know, invasions, and this is probably where it works best, in that if one company owned, like, if WWE just bought us, they would probably, as most companies do when they buy the competition, if you will, you know, UWF got eaten up by WCW, WCW got eaten up by WWE, because they're vested in their own self-interest for their own show. But the fact that NXT is coming to TNA to make our show better, and TNA is going to NXT to make their show better, there's a much more cooperative incentive. And at least thus far, it seems to be working. And I think that adds excitement to the show, but there isn't a negative dynamic of having a WWE representative in the production meeting demanding his way. And I would imagine if TNA management even goes to the NXT shows, I don't know, that they're sitting in on the production meeting and being demanding. Like, it seems to be a very cooperative relationship, so it's working quite well.
Well, the thing I would say too is, you know, some people are like, oh, well, you know, the NXT guys win most of the matches, how can this help, blah, blah, blah. So, listen, I'm a fan. Okay, I'm a wrestling fan. And the reality is, I don't really have time right now to be watching TNA every week to add it to the docket, okay?
Come on, you got an easy job, Brian. You sit and watch TV.
But I will say that I have really been enjoying the TNA guys on NXT. And, you know, if I didn't have so much to do, I probably would at least be checking out TNA every week. Because, dude, Moose is awesome. I've always liked Moose, but, you know, seeing him again doing matches in NXT, and you know, the Hardys did a great job, and, you know, you hear about some of these matches with like Fraxium that are going to be on TNA television, and it's like, man, you know, I'm interested. I don't personally have time, but if I did, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm not sitting there going, oh, well, you know, such and such a person lost, so I'm not going to watch TNA. It's like, I'm not a mark. Like, the talent's cool. I like the matches. So, you know, it would get me to watch TNA, this thing that they've got going back and forth, because I'm seeing things that I'd like to see more of.
And I think, too, like, more so than ever before in the history of wrestling, individual wins and losses aren't as important. Now, obviously, if you lose every match, that's not good. If you win every match, that's great as far as building people or burying people. But just the occasional win or loss here and there, like you say, fans aren't marks anymore. You know what I mean? Like Moose, again, TNA loses all the matches. It's like Moose beat Brian Pillman, the Heritage Cup champion. But it's like, it's not like anybody's going, ah, Pillman's buried. It's like, it was a match. Moose won because Moose happens to be going on to Obafemi. And again, Fraxium came to NXT and they beat a couple of our tag teams. And it's like, okay, as long as our tag teams are also still featured and pushed, no one's going to think anyone's being buried. And you get the excitement of this cross-promotion thing. And the fact that we're actually separate promotion makes it more exciting. And like you say, if you're not like Brian and don't have to watch 40 hours of wrestling a week and then do another 50 hours of podcast talking about that wrestling, you might find it in your time to check out TNA and realize that the crossover is really cool. Like last night on Impact, we had the Hardys and Obafemi against The System, which again, Moose, Eddie Edwards, and Brian Myers. And it's like, that was pretty damn cool to see Moose and Obafemi, I think the first time they've gotten physical in a match, and it was on TNA television. And it was great.
This person says, Lance, how hard is it to stay in shape on the road as a wrestler, especially back in the day when there weren't as many options, especially on the road?
It was... like, again, it was hard, but it was also, it's just your life and your routine. And, you know, I remember Austin back when he had his Austin podcast. I don't think he still has it. You know, he talked about road mode, and it's like you just get into this zombie routine. And, you know, if you're on the road 5 days a week, it's like I wake up in the morning and you go to the gym, then you eat, then you go to the building and you wrestle. And then you drive to the next town, and then you check into a hotel and you sleep, and you get up in the morning and you go to the gym and you go to eat, and then you go to the building. And it's tiresome and it's exhausting, but it's just what you do. And similarly with, again, it's probably a lot easier now because there's a lot of pre-packaged meals and stuff that you can take with you and order in. And actually, they're not on the road much anymore. But in the day, you find the restaurants that have the food that you can eat that fit into your routine. And I would literally order the exact same thing for breakfast, go to the gym, order the exact same thing for lunch, go to the show, you know, have catering at the show, drive to the next town. And it just becomes a robotic process that you mind-numbingly just repeat.
This person says, which company's producers are in charge of cross-promotion segments between TNA and NXT?
Well, at the TNA shows, TNA producers produced the TNA show.
It's just whoever on any given day. There's not like someone specifically assigned to the...
No.
Okay.
If it's a TNA show, TNA producers are there and TNA producers produce the matches. If it's an NXT show, I assume the NXT people... NXT producers produce those matches. Now, obviously, there would be a degree of creative where, again, if there are specific requirements from NXT, whoever the, I don't, again, let's just say it's Sean and Dreamer, for just put two names out there. If they're the ones as far as the creative heads of each place, it's like if Sean has, again, Oba's coming over, if there's something Sean absolutely doesn't want to happen or absolutely does want to happen, I assuming he just tells Dreamer. And then in the production meeting, let's say I'm producing the match, Dreamer's just going to say, hey, make sure this happens and make sure this doesn't happen because that's important for Sean to be like, okay. But TNA producers are working TNA shows and producing NXT talent. I assume the opposite is the case in NXT.
This person here says, I guess this is for me, Kingdom, Bennett, and Taven, Wardlow, are they all gone from AEW? Layla Hirsch is gone. Are they gone too? I've heard nothing about those names being gone. I do know that there are some other people who are gone that it hasn't been made public yet, but I couldn't tell you exactly who it is, but I was basically told, you have not seen this person for a long, long time, and they were not a real big name. So I think more are coming in March, but I don't think you're going to see a lot of like big names.
Could be released. The case of where when you hear that they've been released, you go, really? They still worked there?
Yes. And that's actually kind of what I was told was like, if one of the names in particular, you would ask that person was under contract. So no big names that I know of at this point. All right, this person, this is actually producer Jared, who doesn't even watch wrestling. And he may have the best question of the day. Although I know what you're going to answer, Lance. But like, come on. The question is, what's the coolest move that you wanted to do, but you could never get right? There wasn't one. I was the best national athlete since Barry Windham. Not Ricky Saints. I could do everything.
I don't know if there was ever a move that I wanted to do that I didn't. Now, the one move that there was, because everybody at the time, like when the Shooting Star Press was really just done by Liger in Japan, and there was sort of a, this is the coolest, most difficult move there is to do, there was always in the back of my mind, I think I could do that. But again, this is in an era where crash mats weren't a thing. You didn't have the nice cushy ring at the performance center to try stuff. So to try it, you had to just do it in a ring. If you happen to be lucky enough to find a time where the ring is actually set up and the fans aren't in, like you couldn't try stuff as much. And I know Jericho, like he practiced at on a diving board at a pool. You know, I think in Morristown, Tennessee.
The Shooting Star.
Where I didn't have... Now, granted, I could do, you know, the inverted backflip, you know, and go into the pool feet first off a diving board. But I didn't think that translated into being able to do it off the top rope. So there was sort of in the back of my mind, I think I could do it. I do want to try it at some point, but finding the occasion. And then after I saw Jericho, actually not the time he broke his arm, but the couple nights before that at a house show, he had tried one before the show and came right down on his head. Like not quite Brock Lesnar Mania 19, but as scary. And I was in the arena area, but from a distance, and I saw him, and I was just like, holy shit, he's dead. And I like ran up to him. I was like, are you okay? And he's like, yeah, I think I got some mat burn on my forehead. And he had a small patch of mat burn on his forehead. But he was fine, because Jericho's damn near indestructible. And after seeing that wipe out, and then also the couple nights later when Jericho broke his arm, trying one that didn't look like anything bad at all, I knew at that point I would never be able to try one, because when I got to the top rope, I would be seeing the Jericho land on his head one. So at that point, I'm like, I'm never trying this move. I don't need this move. And I'm glad I never tried it. But coming up with crazy, wacky moves wasn't as big a thing in my era. So I didn't have a lot of occasion to try shit I couldn't pull off.
Well, you know, I made fun of you, but there was no move I couldn't do either. But I think
except the old school classic.
Well, I was going to say, I think Jared asked a question because I was talking about how Buddy always wanted me to do that spot, the high spot, and I just could not figure out how to do that stupid move.
It's all in the base.
But like the question was specifically, what's the coolest move you wanted to do? I never wanted to do that move. I thought the move was stupid. And actually, that wasn't it. Because I would have to be blaming Buddy, and it wasn't his fault as a base. All I could think of, because I would do Frankensteiners. I did Frankensteiners back in the YWF with, like, nerds who knew nothing. And so, like, every time he wanted me to do this move, all I could think about was how to do a Frankensteiner, as opposed to how to do the old school. And so my mind couldn't separate, because you're essentially kind of doing the same thing, but, like, a Frankensteiner is harder, I think, than... But, I mean, it's not to me, obviously. But anyway, the point is, I never wanted to do that move.
I was in the ring. Shawn Michaels was trying to teach Randy, like when Randy Orton was just coming up to the main roster. He was trying to teach Randy Orton how to do the old school head scissor. And it was funny, because Shawn would go up and do it perfectly. And then it's like, Randy would try something, and then Randy would try it, and it's like, it would not go well. And Sean's like, has no idea what to do. And I sort of walk up. It's like, it's because you just hate to do this. This is what you do. Sean's like, is that what I do? I'm like, yes, this is the difference maker. And it's just Sean was one of those guys that didn't even know what he was doing. Like, it was just natural. And he just went up and did it. I'm like, well, if you just hook your foot this way and he just has to base this way. It's like, oh, okay. And then Randy could do it fine with me. But Yeah, Sean was too natural. He didn't even know what he was doing.
Well, you know, when I first started teaching jiu-jitsu, I had the same problem because I had a hard time explaining things that I did to beginners because I didn't think about doing them. It just, my body did it. And so what eventually worked is when I would do it on a person and then have them also do it on me, and then I could feel what they were doing wrong. As opposed to, you know, you just watch them do it to somebody else and go, oh, just put your foot there. Why aren't you? You actually have to like feel, okay, what are you doing? You're doing it totally wrong. And now I understand why, because you did it on me.
I had that in OVW when I first got down there. Everyone kept botching up just the standard neck breaker. You know, they'd send the guy into the ropes, bend over for the backdrop and take the neck. And like everybody would just get jammed up and it was just awful. And it's like, I couldn't, I'm like, what the fuck are they doing wrong? So I literally had to, like, I'd send the person in and like, give me the neck breaker so I could tell what they're doing wrong.
Yes.
And I remember it was Kevin Thorne, the Mordecai, the vampire dude. He was one that would often sit out and observe. And I guess he enjoyed counting. At the end of the day, he's like, dude, do you realize you just took 37 neck breakers? I'm like, did I really? He's like, yep. I'm like, well, yeah, but they're doing the move right now.
At least there's that. Now your neck's broken. 37
consecutive neck breakers.
Based on what's happened last year, this person says, and so far this year with The Rock, do you think he will fill the role that Vince played, which was the big bad authority figure in WWE? Well, the problem is he's not going to be there every week, and he's not going to be there probably that often. So I'm sure that's like the overall role, like he's the final boss, but I'm sure that he's going to have a penultimate boss who's the one who's going to be there on TV every week would be my guess.
I would avoid going down the road of the heel authority figure, A, because I think it sucks, and B, because I think it's associated with Vince McMahon, WWE, and is that is not a connection I would want to be connecting dots for viewers. And like you say, he's not around enough. Like, that was the whole point of the Austin McMahon feud, is they were on every show. They weren't showing up a half a dozen times a year. And again, I don't think The Rock, with his public image, is going to necessarily want to be the modern day Vince McMahon. That is not a moniker I would want.
Spurs says, Lance, what happens if a wrestler calls a spot you don't know how to do? Do you wing it, put him in a headlock, and discuss it further?
Well, more often than not nowadays, if it was anything other than something really standard, you would talk it out ahead of time. With the, hey, do you know how to take this, or are you willing to take this? I actually heard, it was funny because the one of the people standing by was like, oh man, because they saw me roll my eyes. Someone asked someone if they're comfortable taking a gut wrench suplex, and I'm just like, that is like the lowest, easiest suplex bump in the world.
I was going to say, did it's they like, say
if you
no?
Got a problem with that, you're probably in the wrong job, but still better to check. Now, granted, and I actually did this, the one time I worked with AJ Styles, it was a tag match in the UK. It was Daniels and AJ. It was supposed to be CD and AJ against me and Justin with an Impact play, but Justin no-showed, and they ended up having Andy Simmons or Andy Sims. I might have his name wrong, but I'm at least close. I usually don't even remember, but we had it, and AJ, I think, had me in a headlock, and I popped to the top wrist lock, and I'm just like, you know how to do the head scissor out of here? And he's like, yeah. He said, I haven't done that in forever. I'm like, well, do it. And he hit it. He was like, oh, cool. And it was like something that just he had no doubt done back in the day when it was a more common move, and just, you know, do this head scissor? He's like, yeah. I'm like, all right, well, do it.
And, yeah, I think that nowadays, so much of so many matches are choreographed. Or not even, I think when people think choreographed, they think it's kind of like, you know, every single solitary move, 1 through 100 in that exact sequence. But I think it's more,
Spots are discussed, and well, the order of which those spots will be executed
exactly.
are discussed.
Like, hey, okay, we're going to do this sequence at some point. We're going to do this sequence at some point. We're going to do this sequence at some point. And it might get mixed up a little bit. Like, the sequence is memorized and choreographed, but it's not like the entire match from start to finish. But the point is, the way that they do it now, you're not calling a lot of big moves on the fly. You're going over your high spot, in fact, you're 50 of them, which reminds me, actually, I was laughing at Jericho calling that move the high spot. Number one, because he says hi, guys, in the middle of it, but also because in the old days, that was a high spot in a match. It's like, okay, what's our high spot going to be? All right, we got this one high spot, and when it's time, you just call high spot, and then you do the one high spot, and like that's a big thing you do in the match. So like even back in the day when you called more in the ring, it wasn't like you were calling really complicated shit. You were calling basic stuff, and then whatever your big stuff was going to be, okay, well, that you went over beforehand, and you cleared, do you know how to do this thingamajigger or whatever? No? Okay, well, we won't do that. How about this? So rarely out of nowhere are you going to be calling a match in the ring, and some guy's going to go, Canadian Destroyer, and you're going to have to pull it out of your ass.
I remember the one time, the only time I worked with Eddie Guerrero. It was a host show here in Calgary for WWE. It was the one where, again, Vince being, I assume, a dick. I was just supposed to do a promo late in the show because it was last minute. They realized that they were in Calgary and I was on the other brand, but I was home. So they said, oh, show up, do a Brother Love segment and like Seg 7. I'm like, fine. Vince was doing host shows at the time with Zach Gowan. He showed up during the first match. And Vince walked into the building and said, you know what match I'd pay to see? Lance Storm versus Eddie De Guerrero for the U.S. title. Put that match on next. So, like, I got a guy runs in. He's like, you're working Eddie Guerrero. I'm like, my gear's in the car. He's like, well, go get it. You're on next. So I got to run, get my car. So Eddie and I had nothing. Like, as I'm getting my gear on, right before his music hit, Eddie just walks in. He's like, it's your hometown. I'll work more heel. When you're done your comeback, go for a German. I'll ball shot. You hit my finish. I'm like, great. See you out there. And he left. But in the match, I don't remember what we were doing, whether he had a hold on me or whatever. But I remember saying, he's like, do you know that monkey flip spot I do? I'm like, yeah. He says, all right, where are you? You did the leapfrog and roll back? I'm like, yeah. He's like, all right, let's do that. I'm like, sure. I was like, it's just double check.
All right. This person here says, Brian, how would you book Harley Cameron? Would it even be as a wrestler? If it were me, I'd send her on an excursion to get experience, bring her back, build it all around her. Well, building it all around her when she comes back is going a little, like, we don't know how she's going to be when she comes back. But yes, I would absolutely send her on an excursion. I would, there are a lot of, I mean, that's one of the big things with AEW. And even WWE nowadays, now that they don't do so many house shows anymore, it's, you really notice it now. And the name I'm going to bring up, I don't want to single anybody out, but I am, Tiffany Stratton. She got called up to the main roster, and like back in the day, I don't know if you guys remember this or not, but in 2002 or whatever, when they called up Brock Lesnar to the main roster, that dude was not ready to be called up to the main roster.
I was working him on house shows.
That's the point. They immediately got him on house shows with guys like you, and before you know it, this guy's ready. And nowadays, it's like Tiffany got called up too early. Like she was athletic. And she could do like good choreographed matches that they did for a week at the Performance Center or 2 weeks before TV. But like she wasn't really like main roster ready yet. And so she got called up at a time where they're not doing a lot of house shows. And so if you watch Tiffany Stratton now as compared to a year ago, she's basically exactly the same. And I think that's when AEW first started, it was like, you know, one of the benefits to AEW is you only have to work like one or two shows a week. They might do a house show here and there, but you only have to work one. The schedule's easy. It's great. Which, that is a great schedule to only have to work once a week, but
if you're already good.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many people that would benefit from working, you know, every weekend, at least two shows a weekend and TV, and you just don't get it anymore. And so, like, the best guys in WWE, the best guys in AEW are the guys and women that like worked around the world in different promotions and got like tons and tons of matches under their belt. And then they went to WWE or AEW. And, you know, the ones that, you know, they've trained, Maybe they did an indie once a month for, you know, a couple of years. Now they're, it's just like they don't get enough reps. There are not enough reps nowadays.
And that's a shame because we, you know, with back to the original question of Harley Cameron, it's such a shame that there aren't the house shows for her to learn, because sending her away for on excursion, I think you run the risk of putting the flame that's there out, in that people are into her right now. They like her right now. And that's where I think in a perfect world, I would look into trying to feature her in a managerial role of some kind, so that you can capitalize on her popularity, her entertainment value, and keep her featured on TV. But with that, I would then try to, again, if it was a perfect world, if you had those three house shows a week, put her in there with the good workers that you have on the women's roster so that she can then work several times a week and get better, in hopes of, as you're building the talking feud with her in a managerial, and again, doesn't have to be a manager, but some kind of on-screen personality role, that as she's getting the reps on house shows and getting better and better, that when you do pull the trigger and then cut the angle for her to have another wrestling program, she has improved. Dave and I think it was Dave and Garrett on their show. I could be wrong, but I know he was talking about, again, the reps, and talking about how, again, back in the day, you know, if you're 4 years in the business and you're working 200 dates a year, it's like, that's 800 matches. And it's like, now there's some guys that are working 25 matches a year. It's like, well, to get 800 matches at 25 matches a year, what is that? Is that 1,600 matches or 16 years, or is it more than that?
It's not 1,600 years.
No, but, you know, and it's not. And it's like, it's even worse than that. I was like, now that I'm no longer on Twitter, I can't DM Dave. But as I was saying to him, it's like, it's so much different because... I've told this story in here before. My first 3 years in the business, 2.5, 3 years, whatever it was, up until I went to Europe, CWA Catch, I had like 120 matches in the 2.5 years or whatever it was before that. And then the next 5 months in CWA, I had 120 matches again. And like, the learning curve is off the charts, because doing 7 matches a week on occasions, you learn so much more. Because if you make a mistake and are fortunate enough to have somebody with more experience than you pointed out, or the mistake's big enough that even the dumbest, greenest idiot can go, holy fuck, I screwed that up. But if you then get the feedback of, hey, do it this way, and you can go out the very next day and fix it, you fix stuff so much sooner than if you make a mistake in your match and go, oh shit, I shouldn't have done that, I'll have to remember to do it the other way next time. And then your next match is in 3 weeks. It's like, it's not the same thing. So even more so than getting the past the 100 matches, the 300 matches, it's getting them close together where you can really learn. And again, my biggest progression as a worker was that time in CWA where it was like, I'm wrestling every night. And then again, I'm wrestling guys like Dave Taylor and Tony Sinclair and Fit Finley. And it's like, it's just, you know, off the charts. So again, getting her reps, but I think trying to keep her featured on television to maintain the popularity that she has.
I should mention, by the way, if you're watching and or listening to this show free, this is one of 84 shows that we produce every month. I personally do 2 shows virtually every day, some days 3 shows. And you can subscribe in a lot of different ways. If you want to subscribe to the main site, which has not only all of the podcasts, but the entire podcast archive, which means 15,000 shows dating back to 2005, and the Wrestling Observer newsletters and the archives of the Observers. We have a new subscriber discount, 2 of them actually, 1 for monthly and 1 for annually. And you can go to f4wonline.com/new. That is f4wonline.com/new. And you can sign up at a discount and get all of the shows, Observers, everything else. If you only want the shows or you're on a budget, there's 3 options. You can subscribe on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. You get all the shows. And all 3 of those are only $9.99 each.
Audio
and
shows.
What was that?
audio shows.
Yeah, the audio shows. Well, the video on YouTube. So you can get all of that on YouTube. F4WOnline.com/YouTube is $9.99. F4WOnline.com/Spotify is $9.99. And F4WOnline.com/Apple is $9.99. And Apple actually has a free trial. So if you'd like to get a taste of all of the shows, F4WOnline.com/Apple, do the free trial, and then either sign up on Apple, or you can do YouTube, Spotify, or the main site and get everything. So let's do some more questions.
I have one first.
Yes.
Have you ever had a signee crazy enough that claimed he went back to the beginning and binged them all and caught up?
I have never had anyone say they binged, like, every show, but we have had actually many people who have gone back to the beginning and binged every Brian and Vinny show.
Oh, my God.
Yes. That's a lot of shows. That would be, this is just a rough estimate.
I really hope that person had a long commute and just didn't have a life.
That would be 3 shows a week, 52 weeks a year for 20 years. 3,120 shows that they listened to get caught up.
More power to them. I hope he had a long commute.
Hey, I hope they enjoyed it. It's a lot of entertainment for $9.99 a month. All right, this person says, was Hardcore Heaven 1999 back in the day? Lance, you put a garbage can on Dreamer before hitting him with a spinning heel kick for the win. Did you hate that booking?
No.
All right.
I thought it was a big win for me and was quite happy about it. I did. I remember when Dreamer obviously came up with the idea, because the innovator of violence is just him innovating ways for people to perpetrate violence on him. I remember thinking after, like, when he first came up with the idea, I'm like, okay, I'm going to put this can on his head. He's standing in the middle of the ring and he can no longer see at all. So he has no idea when I'm coming. There was no warning at all. Just standing there with a garbage can on his head until whack. And he got hit. So it worked out well. But again, this is where having Dawn Marie was such an advantage to me, because when you're beating a babyface, and again, Dreamer was the perfect babyface because losing was part of his gimmick and what also helped him stay over. But he pile drove Dawn Marie on that show. And it's like, you always want to allow your babyface to accomplish as much as possible if he's not actually getting the W. So we had built up a lot of heat and tension between Dawn Marie continually screwing Tommy. So Tommy got a degree of revenge before. That was also the match where he broke his back. Partway through the match, it was another idea of his. He had me up for the DVD, the Spicoli driver, I think he was the name he used for it, as a tribute to Louis Spicoli. On the ramp, we had the ramp that went to the ring. And I was to slide out behind him and give him the scorpion death drop, the slop drop, whatever you want to call it. And there was the last length of the bridge had to angle down a bit to meet the ring. So there was an edge. And unfortunately, Tommy bumped right on that edge and actually fractured his back and struggled to move, but got through the whole rest of the match because Tommy's a tough son of a bitch that barrels on through. He would enjoy
that's
our
right
show.
He should get a shirt once I make it. Yeah. This person here says, Lance, besides Bret Hart, do you know of any other wrestlers who are artists or good at drawing? Well, Jerry Lawler, obviously. Have you ever drawn before? I'm taking classes now. It is very difficult.
Yeah, the artistic gene skipped me and went with my brother. My brother is both musically talented and artistically, as far as drawing, very talented. My youngest is quite talented in the art department. I am not. The things I'm best at drawing require a ruler and straight lines. So I don't draw, and I really can't think of... Don Callis actually has a degree of artistic... ability to him. I've actually got we were doing a signing in ECW and he was doodling and did a me, PJ, Dawn Marie cartoon sketch on one page that I kept, and I don't know if I have the original or whether I just scanned it at some point and saved it on my computer. Perhaps I'll throw it out there on my threads and Blue Sky account on Instagram if I can find my copy of the Don Callis artwork of the Impact Players.
Really? You know, it's funny you mentioned the gene. I'm not a Picasso or anything like that, but I'm a pretty good artist, actually. And I see, like, Paisley draw now, and she's, like, a really good artist. And she draws exactly like me, which is weird, because I've never, like, shown her any... Because I used to do comics and cartoons when I was a kid. And she draws these characters exactly like I did. It's uncanny. And, like, Granny... I was over at Granny's house the other day. She's got this sketch pad. She wants the kids to, like, make a drawing to put outside her old folks' home. And so I open up this sketch pad, and there's, like, this freaking drawing of, like, a lady. And I'm like, who drew this? And she goes, I did. Like, she's a really, like, really good artist. And then her son, Terry, was an incredible artist. And her son, Wayne, was, like, a great artist. So it seems weird to say that, like, being able to draw would be a genetic thing. Like, it doesn't even make sense. But there's got to be some, whatever it is, whether it's, like, a gene for creativity or being able to, you know, recreate something that you see or whatever it is. It's weird, though.
Left brain, right brain thing, perhaps.
It could be. Lance, would you wrestle one more match against Chris Jericho for the Ring of Honor title?
Probably not. I think I would consider doing if Jericho was going to retire, we would do one with each other as we sort of always sort of considered or joked about or promised we would do. I would consider, but I'm really retired. I've had a lot of people asking. I was like, no, I'm done. I think I have enough aches and pains and difficulties in life now. I think for the most part, I was very fortunate to get out in one piece and not require a bunch of surgeries. And I think my body is best just not to do it again, because I wouldn't want to half-ass it and do, like, I could do a match where I don't take a bump and it would be easy as can be, but I wouldn't be happy with that. So I suspect the Matt Hardy match where I super kicked Missy Hyatt will probably be my last. It was also the match where I did probably the coolest thing I ever did in my life. There's video of it somewhere. I don't know. Someone will find it. But they threw streamers, and I very casually just reached up and palmed the one as it went by me and caught it and threw it back to the crowd. It was one of the cooler moments of my life. That'll probably be my last one.
I was gonna say, it might have been the only one.
That's possible, too.
Michael says, I started watching TNA due to the crossover. There you go.
Well, good for you. Hope you're enjoying it.
Yeah. All right, this person here says, have you ever read the Nick Mason series by Steve Hamilton? If not, you should.
Actually, I think I might have read a couple. I could be wrong, but it sounds familiar. I think it was a case of, I've got a Calgary library card, and I use the Libby app so you can sign out e-books from the library. And I think that was one that had a couple and someone else had recommended, and I read a couple, and then unfortunately there was like a couple more, but the library didn't have them, and I switched to something else, but I think I did read a couple.
This person here says, Lance, where was your favorite arena or locale to wrestle at? Did you have a favorite?
I don't know. There was a few that I really enjoyed, but I wasn't one to, you know, like, I've mentioned this before, for whatever reason, I was like just stupid over in the Maritimes. I don't know why. Like, we did WWE house shows out there, and it's just like, I'm like the most over guy in the show. I'm like, what? They were real big supporters of me, so that was always fun. The arena in Philly was always fantastic. But other than that, like, obviously Calgary, I got good reactions. Toronto, I'd get good reactions. But for the most part, I just enjoyed wrestling. And if the crowds were excited, like, again, Chicago always had a good crowd, so I looked forward to it. But I enjoyed just working everywhere.
Spurs says, I've heard wrestlers all over the world call matches in English. Did you ever match with someone who spoke such bad English or had such an accent that it made calling the match hard or impossible?
Well, that would be a case of you then plan things completely ahead of time. And more often in my generation, like, I think I've told this story before, like my first match in Japan, I wrestled, I guess there were two Japanese guy and a Korean guy that I had never met, never spoke to ever before in my life, did not know if any of them actually spoke English. Actually, I knew Onita spoke a little bit, but like we just went out there and wrestled and didn't call anything. We just fought and did shit. And that's it. Like, that can be done. And, you know, you sort of touched on it, Brian, where there might be someone, if you have really bad language skills, that you, you know, get together with an interpreter or someone and sort of talk out and pantomime and walk through a high spot and then pantomime and walk through the finish with someone helping you explain. And if they seem to understand the high spot and seem to understand the finish, you just go out and wrestle for the rest. Like, you just grapple and wrestle, and if you start beating the guy up, if he thinks he's getting beat up too much, he'll fight back and you let him. And if he's beating you up too much, you fight back and you hope he lets you. And when the crowd starts getting bored, you go, high spot! And you do the planned high spot, and then you do that shit some more. And then when you're like, okay, we need to get the fuck out of here, you go, okay, finish! And then you do the finish. It's not like you have to...
You don't need to be sitting there and having like a conversation the entire match.
No.
I mean, there's plenty that you can do without even talking to the other person.
Yep. And back in my day, that happened a lot. I had matches where I never spoke to the guy at all. You might hope he understands move, but you just do it.
I actually had a match with a Lucha guy. This was a long time ago. This was like 25 years ago or something like that. It might have been like a Tito Carrion show or something like that. And it was like at the last second I found out I was working this guy. And he spoke no English and I didn't speak a lot of Spanish. And it was essentially, I would either just say move or don't move in Spanish. And like we just like, you know, just did whatever. And then when it was like time to go up or down or whatever, it was like move, don't move. And that was it. And the rest was just like whatever. The only time, like usually, yes, if you're going to have like a big match and it's two guys speak different languages, like let's say you go to New Japan and there's someone who for some reason speaks no English, which most of them speak enough English to do a match. But if, say, there's somebody new, they speak no English, you're going to have an interpreter there. Or you're going to have a referee who can interpret between the two as the match is going on. The issue is when you have everything planned out and everything, and then, like, some shit goes awry, and then, like, you know...
That's when things get fun.
Nobody knows what to do, and the referee... Like, I don't want to name an exact incident, but this has happened in America with guys that don't speak English, and they happen to have a referee who only speaks English, and the wrestler only speaks English, and then like after the match is over, like something's going down and the guys that speak Spanish don't understand what the referee is trying to tell them, and they do their thing. So, you know, like, things like that have happened before, but, you know, in general it can be worked around.
I remember the first time Don Callis got Jericho to bring Ultimo Dragon into Winnipeg for some dates. And I remember having to be the interpreter. I sat there with Dragon and whoever the English-speaking person was, and I had to translate English to broken English, because if you've ever worked with a lot of Japanese wrestlers or if you've been to Japan, most of them speak a degree of English, but there's sort of a very specific broken English version.
Yes.
They speak.
Yes.
And there's certain words you have to use for them to understand. So I was the translator translating English to broken English, which seemed absurd, but it worked.
Yeah, like sometimes you hear people that are like, they'll do like a fake Japanese accent. And, you know, some people say you're being racist or whatever, but really you're not.
You're speaking broken English to a Japanese person.
That is exactly, like, sometimes, you know, we got some places, there's tons of Asians in this area. And, you know, sometimes I'll go to like a teriyaki place, and like the people that work there, they don't speak a lot of English at all. And, you know, you basically talk to them the way that they talk to you. There's like a very specific way of doing it. And when you communicate with them the way they communicate with you in kind of that broken English, and, you know, like, I don't want to throw them under the bus or anything, but, you know, we've had and this is back in the day when we did more interviews, where Dave and I would interview somebody who didn't speak great English, like a Japanese pro wrestler. And like, to me, I always feel like there's a way you got to ask this question. Like, not a lot of words, simple, you know what I'm saying? There's a way. But then like Dave would ask this like 2-minute question. Just like he's like talking to you. And I know this person doesn't understand half of what he's talking about, but he just like barreled on through his question. Cause that's the thing on this site, just barrel on through. But you know, oftentimes like it's not racist. It actually helps with the communication because they have a way of English that they're speaking to you. And if you speak that way back, you guys communicate just fine. But if you try to speak to them and like you're speaking to somebody else that speaks English, they're going to be lost.
Yes, you have to speak Japanese broken English, and it works.
Yes. This person here says, how important do you think entrance music is to a person's overall gimmick?
I think it's really big. I won't name names, but there was a person that someone had asked me. It's like because they would always get over in their matches, but never got that big pop when they come out. And I'm like, I think it's their entrance music. Like, there just isn't that celebratory power to their music. So as a babyface, it doesn't elicit that same explosive response. And again, you know, you were talking about it with the Royal Rumble. It's like all this fucking music sounds the same. And it's like, if you can have that song, like the Hardys always get a great reaction, but that music is just so energetic and immediately identifiable that it always gets that pop and it really helps. But if it's a slower song that takes a while to get there, it's like you're not going to get that same explosiveness. And when it was you and I and Vinny, we did the Saturday Night's Main Event to watch along with Jericho that one time, and we talked about the power of using real music. You know, like when Cult of Personality hits for Punk, it's like it's immediately identifiable and it connects with you. And so many of the good themes back in the day, you identify immediately. And I remember I listened to a podcast or something. It was an interview with Burton Cummings, who, again, Canadian musician, part of the Guess Who back in the day. Not the Who, the Guess Who. And he talked about how he was really hoping in his career to have at least one hit that, like, in that first 2 or 3 notes is just immediately identifiable where the crowd will pop. And then he mentioned that he ended up being very fortunate and had a few of them. He was actually the originator of American Woman, not was it Lenny Kravitz that redid it? Mm-hmm. But Burton Cummings and I think the Guess Who were the original behind it. But there's certain songs that in that first 2 or 3 beats, like, it strikes an emotional chord with you. And I think good entrance music can do that. And bad entrance music is just background noise.
Spur says, Jericho did a podcast with Nakamura when he first came to NXT and he talked in broken English the whole interview. Exactly. That's what you do. All right.
Jericho logged a lot of time in Japan.
Yes, he did. Okay, we got one more here. We got time for one more. Sorry if we didn't get to your question, but we'll be doing these once a month. So follow us on my X at Brian Alvarez or click like and subscribe on YouTube and you'll get notifications. But it says, Lance, now that you have been a trainer and owned a school, what did the heart school you attended do right and wrong in hindsight? Was it more of a cash grab?
Well, it was definitely a cash grab, but what they did right is they taught good, basic, solid fundamentals. Like, they started right at the beginning and made sure your headlocks, your hammer locks, your arm bars, all of that stuff was good and reliable, and same with bumping. And emphasizing, because again, in that generation, the cooperative, light working nature of the business. So they gave really great fundamentals. Now, what they didn't offer, and again, in a different time, you probably didn't have to, because when you started, you just started as a bottom guy and worked your way up. It's like they taught zero ring psychology whatsoever. I remember telling Jericho afterwards, it's like, can you believe we went all the way through camp and the terms heat and comeback were never mentioned once? Like, it was just, these are your moves, these are your bumps, and go have matches. And so obviously I added more of that to my school, but the solid foundation and fundamentals were provided very well and gave us a good base. And thankfully I got to work with the Jerry Morrows, the Gama Sings, and the Johnny Smiths early so that they could teach me ring psychology. Even Lenny Luther in AEW, he was a couple years ahead of us that went through the Hart School. And when I finally worked with him, he had basic understanding of ring psychology and could actually call a match. And he was one of the early guys that could actually like call you through a match and was really good. So that was a big benefit.
All right. Well, I want to thank everybody who participated today. We plan to do these monthly. And if you like the show as noted, sign up today at Wrestling Observer website, fwonline.com/new. There are new subscriber options there for monthly and annual subscriptions, 85 podcasts a month, Observer newsletter and more. That's fwonline.com/new. Or you can sign up on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. All of those, $9.99. Just put fwonline.youtube/YouTube, fwonline.com/Spotify, fwonline.com/Apple, and it'll take you to the page to sign up. And Lance, any final plugs before you go?
Yeah, March 14th, El Paso, Texas, Sacrifice, our next big app special. I believe last night on the show, they announced that Jeff Hardy will be challenging Moose for the X Division title in a ladder match. There is a 10-man tag. There is, who is Masha defending? I'll check, follow TNA Wrestling on Instagram or Threads. They will have all the matches. I don't want to stooge some off that aren't billed yet, but I know they announced four new matches for the show last night on Impact. Again, every Thursday night, 8 p.m. Eastern on Access and Sportsnet 360 in Canada. And we are doing more live shows. Some of them are still taped, but we're doing more frequently live shows. So again, March 14th and 15th in El Paso. The 14th is Sacrifice. 15th will be a TV taping. So check us out in El Paso, Texas.
And that's it, everybody. We're going to wrap it up for today. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you this weekend. Elimination Chamber and a lot of news. We'll talk to you again after a while.
Adios.